Hello. Welcome to the Agile Tao, a show about the deep roots of agility. Every time I talk to Peter, and today with a bunch of Australian crickets, about the view that Taoism had on what agility is. Hello, Peter.
Hello, Dov.
And today we talk about what?
So I think we have today a poem that really drives at the fundamental of agility. Ward Cunningham said that 80% of agile is just effective collaboration and the rest is bookkeeping. So this is a poem that's about collaboration. And it's neat because it gives us a bunch of distinctions we can actually play with and examine in the context of organizations that you always want to drive us towards.
So let's dive into it. Collaboration.
Chapter 22, Collaboration. Agility builds collaboration, not competition. Feeds interdependence, not dependence. Empties people's mouths to fill their bellies. Softens their hearts to strengthen their bones. It controls politics by not privileging responsibility. Bureaucracy by not delegating management. Scarcity by not allocating roles. Agility decentralizes ownership and leadership, so those who provide them can't exploit them. When no one can take advantage, harmony remains.
Okay. When I talk about collaboration, I often talk about the phenomena of murmuration. The phenomena of big cloud of birds that act as one.
Yeah.
And the big secret in the way that the murmuration behaves is not the birds, but the distance between them and how they react to each other. So when I talk about it, I present the murmuration as something that exists in the space between the birds and not in the birds themselves. So collaboration is a topic that I adore, and of course it's a big part in the agile mindset. Can we dive into the poem?
Yeah, we can, but I want to answer you on your murmuration for a moment. For those who aren't familiar with the word, this is the behavior of a flock of birds. Often we talk about a murmuration of swallows. You see that the way that the flock behaves, it looks more like a jellyfish than a flock of birds. It's coherent. There is an order, a dynamic order that responds to the winds and presumably the interests of the birds as a flock. But I would like to pick on a slightly different animal. I like to talk about pods of dolphins as opposed to a dancing elephant, because you have about the same amount of biomass in an elephant as in a pod of dolphins. An elephant can catch bananas on a tree. It cannot catch a school of fish. If you go on YouTube and look for dolphins hunting, and you will find many videos of dolphins collaborating to catch schools of fish, they're just jaw-dropping, and often they will collaborate with other creatures, whales or birds, seals, to do this. When you watch it, it makes you feel a little bit inferior as a human. We're good at collaborating, we're not that good. So I agree with you that there are lessons to take from nature when it comes to collaboration that we're still learning. I also think of it in this context of the flow of learning, and this is where I distinguish between a murmuration of birds and a pod of dolphins. Murmuration of birds can learn some simple things, but a pod of dolphins can learn a great deal about everything that's going on and all of the other creatures that it has to collaborate with, that a murmuration of birds will simply run away from. Collaboration as an artifact of the flow of learning between multiple minds. That's something where I'll trump your memoration with my pod.
As I recall from a previous poem, there's only one mind. So when you say a collaboration of minds, it sounds like there are several minds.
Weird, doesn't it? Yeah, well, I guess you could also think that an ecosystem contains many ecosystems and so on. English, though, is just funny plastic stuff. It's wibbly wobbly. So we're always tempted to talk in terms of individuals. And when we start adopting a Taoist perspective and we think of a continuous surface of mind and our minds is just ripples on it, well, I guess we get a bit fractal about it.
Okay. And can we break down the poem? Just let's read it line by line.
Sure. Also, for a start, for those who are interested in translating it back to or mapping it back to the Chinese, this is a combination of stanzas from the traditional chapter 12 and the traditional chapter 3. They fit together so neatly that I can't think of those as separate anymore. Hence, they're a single chapter. So, agility builds collaboration, not competition. It's immediately talking in terms of a clear distinction. And we see this distinction turn up in most of the organizations we work with. When we reward people competitively, it becomes very difficult for them to collaborate. This is part of the beauty of approaches like throughput accounting and open book management. If we can reward people based on the same metrics, not KPIs that individuals have, and if we can measure their performance, not in terms of some vanity metric about velocity, but actual end-to-end business throughput. So we've got collective ownership of business outcomes. Then we see collaboration. If we don't do that, then we often see, they may be agile teams or scrums or whatever you want to call them, but we see this behavior where one team might be under a lot of pressure and struggling, and the other team has got to a bit of clear water and it's happy. And so the first team, they're working extra long hours and they're under a lot of stress and they might be working weekends or evenings. And the people in the team that's in the clear air or clear water, they'll turn to the people on the other team and go, "Oh, so sorry to hear about that. We're going to go home and see our families now. We're going to take care of our children, tuck them into bed, and so on. And we're going to have a weekend or an evening to ourselves. Bye!" And off they go. And they're not collaborating in the sense they don't have shared ownership of outcomes. And because they don't, off they go. And they feel good. We achieved ours. Our bonus is coming. Our shares are secure. You guys, not so much. You're going to have to work hard. And people will look at this when they're prioritizing the work to do as well. They'll try to give themselves an easy run if they can manage to get it so that they can spend more time with the people they love. There's nothing wrong with that. What's wrong is in the reward models and the accounting paradigm. So if we change that, then the way that people behave changes. In the original XP, one of the fundamental principles of XP is shared code ownership for the same reason. If one bit of code needs work and another bit of code doesn't, and you guard the quality problems in your bit of code because it's yours, then we're not really properly collaborating, whether we're within a single team or multiple. So that's the first line. Feeds interdependence, not dependence. In Agile, we often talk about dependencies. We even have techniques for mapping dependencies. If we think more about the mutual benefit that we're going to get from performing the work, we can abstract out the dependencies to be technical features in their own right. And the way we go about prioritizing then is simply rational. The idea of mutual benefit, a network of mutual benefit, that needs to be the fundamental of the way that we collaborate. Where we say, "Oh, well, there are these dependencies and they will have to be managed," we're not thinking very hard about that network of mutual benefit as the fundamental. We've lost something. And this is where we have delegation of responsibility turning on us, because it's not bad to delegate a responsibility. We want to identify responsible individuals, but we also want to support them. And if instead we go, well, they've got a dependency on this group, and they're going to have to manage that dependency, we're ignoring the mutual benefit between the groups. The mutual benefit is all about business outcome. They should be working together to deal with this interdependence.
And in fact, when I read these two lines, they both bring to mind that a team, in fact, collaboration, dependence, can happen on many levels. Mm-hmm. So we can have a team of people who collaborate, and we can have a group of teams that collaborates, and we can have a group of departments that collaborates, if this is the structure of your organization. So when there's true collaboration on all levels, there are no dependencies. Because if now I have to do something, or the next thing that has to be done, mm-hmm. because again, it's even not me,
yeah.
is something that depends on something else, then the something else is the thing that needs to be done now. And everyone, just like the pod of dolphins that you described before, yeah. does anything they can to do that thing.
Yes.
So for me, these two lines are, in fact, related very strongly, because
yes.
dependency is a matter of competition.
Yeah.
Is a matter of, this is your part and this is my part, so now I am dependent on you.
Yeah, rather than, hey, why don't we try and find a way to achieve the outcome together? And yeah, you've got some responsibility you're taking, and I've got some I'm taking, but we're both going to do what we need to do together to achieve the outcome, rather than you saying, that's your job, that's my job. If you've got a problem with your job, that's your problem. Which brings us to the third line. Empties people's mouths to fill their bellies. I really love the way that words that, you know, all of these are commonplace words in English, mouths and bellies and filling and emptying. But this line is something that when you read it, you go, wait a second, how does that work? I mean, there's a beauty in this line, there's a symmetry in it. If your mouth is full of words, you're full of discussion, you're full of planning, you're not worrying about how do we actually get the belly full. You're worrying about defending your patch. You're worrying about, how do I look good? How do I turn up well? How do I seem honorable? Rather than, how are we going to make certain that together we actually benefit from this thing in such a way that all of our bellies are full, whether maybe it's complementary. It's not just a matter of suppliers and consumers. We could think in terms of plants and animals, where the waste of one becomes the feed of the other, and vice versa. That kind of filling the bellies, the mutual benefit aspect, that's got to be the fundamental. If we don't find ways to do that, then it doesn't matter whether you feel perfectly happy if your patch, your job is done. The business won't grow as quickly. And if the business doesn't grow as quickly, then all of us are poorer, no matter what part of that business ecosystem we play.
And in fact, when you say fill their bellies, is to fill our belly.
Yeah. So then, softens their hearts to strengthen their bones. We talked about this one earlier, and this is part of part two, where we were talking about open mind and warm heart and coiled spine as the fundamental attributes of agility, of agile mindset, softens their hearts. We often wind up, particularly in a coaching context, working towards this. We have people who, they believe they're behaving very efficiently, very effectively. They are very good at their business. They don't necessarily take care of the other people who are involved. And they might look at those people and go, well, they are weak. They are stupid. We don't have to worry about bringing them along. They are the old guard. They are the inflexible. They are the waterfall. They are the command and control. They are the management, or they are the whatever distinction we make. No, we have to actually care about what's going on with them. If we're going to, particularly as coaches, to be able to improve matters, we have to find wins for everybody. Softening their hearts means that they have to actually start caring about their mutual benefit. Strengthening their bones comes from those kinds of interdependent, mutually beneficial relations. Those are the bones here are the bones of the organization. The beauty, again, is we have this couplet that, again, it's using ordinary words, but the metaphor is very deep and beautiful. And when we apply it to really achieve this, it brings about a joy in work. It's not just gratifying to the people doing the work. It's incredibly more productive and profitable for the people doing the work. In XP days, we used to talk about the XP pop, where you would start doing the various practices. And then the team would gel, and all of a sudden, people would be taking care of each other and completing each other's work, and pairing and merciless refactoring. These things became second nature. Many scrums never get there, even if they're doing CICDD and so on. That pop comes from this kind of thinking within teams and between teams.
In another version that I like, It says, empties the desire. And what I like in these couple of lines is that the belly and the bones, as I said before, are a collective entity. It's not the bellies of the people or the bones of the people, but as you said, the bones of the organization, the belly of the organization that feeds the people who are there.
When you see your pod of dolphins hunting, sharing the bait ball of sardines or other small fish, and they're not worrying about, well, I'm going to get more sardines than you today. The fact is they can't hunt a bait ball of sardines individually. They have to collaborate, and they take turns diving through it with their mouths open while the rest of them all circle around. There's a nice African proverb that if everybody shares in the cooking, then everybody shares in the eating. The way that we work in an agile context, we share the work, the collective ownership of the work and of the tools and of the code base and so on, and of the market, if we're talking about open book management, that's critical to maximizing the yield.
In fact, one metaphor that comes to mind is the shared responsibility of a team.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And I love the definition of responsibility as the ability to respond.
Yes.
The ability of every individual to respond is different. And when we manage to combine this, we get a very powerful response ability of the team itself, because it can do magic that no person can do, even if his ability was 10 times fold, because everyone is able to respond in another direction.
This is the harmony word that we're driving for at the end of the poem, but we'll get there. So if we go to the second stanza, it controls politics by not privileging responsibility. It's fine to identify responsibility. We have to understand what the mission of the team is and what the mission of each individual is as they're achieving that larger mission, what the mission of the business stream is as the teams take responsibility for different parts of this. That's great. But the idea that we say, this person is responsible for, he's the COO or the CEO or whatever, and therefore they have a privilege. If they have an opinion, their opinion will win. The HIPPO, the highest paid person's opinion, will win. That doesn't work very well. We can't hand out those sorts of privileges. The keys to the executive washroom. Why would there be keys to an executive washroom? It doesn't make any sense. We're not actually helping get the work done. So all of the nonsense around, to get a good CEO, he has to have massive remuneration, he has to have those sorts of privileges. Perhaps there is something magical about CEOs. But in my experience, most of them got there by being good managers, good leaders, and if they do their job well, they mentor good managers and good leaders, and we wind up with organizations full of them. If we then say, well, only one of us can be Steve Jobs, well, then when Steve Jobs dies, the organization is going to become less than it was. And that certainly is what happened. Sorry, Tim Cook. Anyway, it controls politics by not privileging responsibility, and bureaucracy by not delegating management. So management is something we have to have. If we don't efficiently, effectively manage the work and the way of working, we're going to have a bad time. But we can do that together. There's lots of really neat, really simple ways to share the responsibility for management. Now, I'm speaking heresy from the point of view of a PMI, PMBOK, PRINCE2, for that matter, DSDM kind of an organization.
In fact, it's okay. It's not you. It's Lao Tzu who speaks.
Oh, that's okay. I want to be practical about it. After all, we already said at the start of section two that agility is practical, not mystical. So how do we share those responsibilities? We have a very simple pattern language. We don't like to sprue at X-Scale, but there's a pattern language in X-Scale called leadership as a service. Three simple patterns. Directly responsible individuals. Every agenda item or work item has to have one person who carries responsibility for execution. Decide the decider. That person, if they're going to need other people to help them get something done and they have to meet with them and hand out responsibilities, then they get to decide who they're going to hand those things out to. They get to invite people. But the best of all is a little pattern we call balance of powers, which basically says, if we're having a meeting to make a decision about some set of items, each of those items will, whether it's a work item or an agenda item, will have a DRI. In that meeting, if everybody else is opposed to the decision that the DRI favors, then they can overrule the DRI. If they're not unanimous in their opposition, then the DRI will make the decision. That kind of dynamic motivation to make trade-offs is enormously powerful. It generates consensus decision-making without telling people that you have to reach consensus. They simply find it in their to their mutual benefit to do so. And it motivates trade-offs, intelligent trade-offs. So, well, I'm happy to do it your way if you're happy to do this bit my way. These sorts of trade-offs are dynamic. They'll change from week to week. But everybody winds up on the same page, as opposed to everybody deferring to, oh, that manager we delegated the decision to, I tried to influence him, you tried to influence him, and you were more effective in influencing than I was, so you got your way. That's a political game. This leadership as a service protocol brings it down to mutual benefit. Enough of the practical. Shall we go on?
Yes.
Okay, so we've had it controls politics by not privileging responsibility. Bureaucracy by not delegating management. Scarcity by not allocating roles. We might say you are responsible for this release or for this piece of software or for this business outcome. But that isn't your role. Your role is to be a team member. At whatever level of the organization you're operating, you're working with people, you are collaborating with people to achieve a mutually beneficial outcome. That's your role. Your role is to be in the organization like a dolphin with the other dolphins. And if that means, well, right now you are the dolphin who is diving through the bait bowl with your mouth open, fantastic. But that's not going to be all that you do. You're not the person who eats the sardines and the rest of us don't. For that matter, when it comes to the way that we're herding the sardines, sometimes some dolphins will be under the bait bowl. Sometimes there'll be others that are traveling this way or that way, or for that matter, you can even have dolphins that are flying through the air and splashing down on top of it, all to move the sardines into a concentrated bowl that everybody can feed from. Those are not roles. They are temporary responsibilities, and the fluidity of them goes towards this idea of an agile organization. If we are assigned fixed roles, if they're not dynamic, if we're not taking our responsibilities as team members to each other first, then we're not going to be anywhere near as agile or as effective an organization.
And you talked about the team. I'd like to say a word about this concept of teams, because for me, everyone is in the same team. So when you start with an organization, you have people in teams. We have some sort of a pyramid hierarchy. Mm-hmm. So I'm a member of a team, and my team is a member in a team of teams, and so on. Mm-hmm. And when I'm a team member, I can be a team member of my small team, and I can be a team member of my big team. Meaning I can contribute to the scarcity that now my team faces in its individual mission, but I can also be a team member of the larger team, and as a team member attend to the larger need of the organization that is not formally specified yet, perhaps, as something that my team is responsible for. So when you say a team member, it can mean a lot of things depending on how agile the organization is.
Yes. We like to talk about autonomous teams, but those teams have to align to each other and to the business outcome. Same as if we think of a team as one of the dolphins in the pod, well, those dolphins have to align to the business outcome. If they behave in a way that scatters the sardines, that's not going to do any of them any good, even though they might be behaving autonomously. So this idea of autonomy in alignment, as opposed to command and control, becomes the fundamental for business agility, for the ability to respond to changes in the market. Okay. Agility decentralizes ownership and leadership. Agility decentralizes ownership and leadership. In XP, we had this concept of shared code ownership or collective code ownership. And at the time, it was considered very extreme, maybe the most extreme part of extreme programming. This was critical for the ability to refactor the code. If you're going to eliminate the duplications and the unnecessary cycles of dependency, or if you can factor them out, then you have to be able to touch code that you didn't originally author. Now, you have to be able to work on code that you don't know the effect of your changes, except in terms of the test automation. This is why test automation, test first, test driven, was so fundamental. Without the test automation, you couldn't do collective ownership. Without collective ownership, you couldn't do merciless refactoring, and that meant that the cost of change for your code base would go steadily up and up and up, usually exponentially up and up. Well, in our organizations, we use interfaces, microservices, and so on, to enforce loose coupling. So that way we can say, hey, your team is responsible for this part of the code, my team, that part of the code, and we have an interface we will respect, so we don't tread on each other's toes. That's natural in large organizations. We might have more lines of code than any set of tests or any set of developers could really guarantee the consistency for. Maybe with some property-based testing, but I'm going too far down a geeky path. But the point here is the factoring of the organization needs refactoring. The way that we work together, the form of the organization has to respond to changing market conditions. A lot of the time that turns up as reprioritization. And that has to happen continuously. So the idea of decentralized ownership is this idea that we're going to have learning flow through the organization, and we're all going to respond to it as best we can. We're not going to worry about having centralized ownership of outcome. We're going to work collaboratively towards shared outcome. And then decentralized leadership. Well, we're used to talking about servant leaders, but people still have this idea of a hierarchy, a command and control hierarchy, where these managers in the command and control hierarchy are going to somehow behave as our servants. And we'll say to them, we'll waggle our fingers as agile coaches, no, you have to behave more like a servant leader. The protocol I talked about before, leadership as a service, means that we can bring together people with wildly different competencies, wildly different power levels in the organization, and have them work as peers to make mutual benefit happen with regard to whatever decision their group is trying to deal with. And we can also move away from the idea of hierarchy as a tree of managers and towards hierarchy as a relationship between the responsibilities of teams. Now, this line decentralizes ownership and leadership. It's part of a couplet. So agility decentralizes ownership and leadership so those who provide them can't exploit them. That seems like it's something that we don't want to actually admit to as product owners, as scrum masters, as project managers or product managers, or as executives or whatever. We don't want to think we're exploiting our position. But we're climbing the greasy pole. We want to benefit our families. And if that means we have to step on a few heads to get things done, well, that's the way life works. So if we decentralize ownership and leadership, how do we get ahead? What benefits us? This comes down to sharing equity and growing equity. This is the way startups think. But the large businesses we work for often don't share equity at all. This is where techniques like open book management live, because we don't necessarily have to share equity to be able to achieve this ideal of decentralized ownership, where people are not exploiting each other to get mutual benefit. And realistically, mutual benefit is win-win. It's positive sum. We don't need to tread on each other to achieve it. And then the question is, well, okay, but can't I get further ahead if I am prepared to exploit people than if I am always focusing on mutual benefit? And that comes down to the rules of the game in the organization. How does the organization reward people? Does it reward them for achieving their job? Does it reward them for achieving the business outcomes, for improving business throughput, for opening the market bottleneck? If it's the latter, then it's defined in such a way that even the most ruthless sociopath will have to figure out how mutual benefit works to be able to achieve their end. So again, if we can change the rules of the game, we can change the behavior of the players. We've seen this before. Agility decentralizes ownership and leadership so those who provide them can't exploit them. That's the rules of the game. When no one can take advantage, harmony remains. Now we wind up in a realm. Rawls, his idea was that a game is fair, or a system is fair, if we can say to everyone in the system, you don't know what your role in this system is or in this game is. You could be any of these roles. Are you still happy with this system? If you would be the most disadvantaged role in the system, would you still be happy with this system? Rawlsian ethics is nice and effective because it provides us with a simple practice, a practical way to go about determining whether something is ethical or not. It's an interesting way to approach things like the trolley problem. If we have a situation where no one can take advantage, where exploitation can't happen, we're coming back to the pot of dolphins, then harmony remains. So this idea of taking something away, taking advantage away from the network of mutual benefit, that's a very Taoist view of how our organizations work. When we're a manager trying to get a larger equity stake or a pay rise or whatever, we're trying to take advantage, well, your shares are not worth anything unless mutual benefit occurs. Maybe we should be thinking more about how do we set up games like this where mutual benefit is the only way to win them, when we're trying to define the way our organization works, or for that matter, when we're trying to define the way our market works. This is where organizations like Apple, Facebook, Google, Amazon, the banks, and so on, this is where they're on a very good wicket. If you think about a bank, we think of banks as ruthless creatures that exploit everybody. The fact is, they are connecting their borrowers and their lenders for mutual benefit. I would much rather be a lender than a borrower. But every once in a while, you do need to borrow to be able to generate benefit that can then potentially make you a lender. I am not defending capitalism by any stretch of the imagination. I think we have a lot of problems in that system where a Rawlsian view of it would suggest to you that this is not a very fair system. However, idea of harmony, that's not something that's just a woo-woo ideal, you know, where the Beatles sang about. I think they did actually sing about, talked about love and peace, but I think it meant harmony. It's just that harmony doesn't rhyme with very much. Anyway.
They sang in harmony.
Yeah, exactly. They certainly did. And the harmony in their group was insuperable. It was wonderful. There's something about the Beatles to say here that they're a little group. Harmony occurs easily in small groups. It's when you have large groups that we get wars and revolutions and banks and so on, or exploitative, in the exploitative sense. We need to understand how to define these simple relationships with small numbers of representatives of teams to link the teams together. The idea of descaling, decentralizing, sharing. If we can't define those relationships with little numbers, even though we might have an enormous, huge fractal organization composed of them, if we can't do that, we can't expect harmony. It doesn't work that way. That's where the Dunbar series goes.
And in fact, you answered the question that I had while listening to this, because I thought of a leader of a huge organization that would hear this and would say, yeah, but I would love to see a group of 10,000 dolphins attack something.
Yeah.
How do they share the responsibilities there? Huh?
Yeah.
How do they share the catch that they found in such a large group?
Yeah.
And you just answered that.
Yeah.
So thank you for this.
Very well.
And one thing that I see here is that not only the last line, but also the part before talks about the importance of removal, what not to do rather than what to do. What to avoid, what to look for and diminish.
Yeah. We often are stuck looking for what shall we do to improve things rather than what shall we stop doing to improve things. That's one of the beauties of retros, is we get to reflect on those sorts of things. And if we extend that to quality circles and rotating councils of quality circle representatives, now I am going down an X-scale path, well, then we can extend the flow of learning beyond a team to the flow of learning through the organization. That's where those little numbers and little connections, face-to-face, small world, those become essential. Without them, we're going to get people compromising and voting and bullying. And I'm not saying democracy is bad, but if we can get consensus decision-making and move towards trade-offs rather than compromises, that's a very different direction. So that's collaboration.
Very complex part of the book.
Beautiful.
Can we finish down by gathering all these scattered ideas into one big reading of the poem?
I'll give it a shot. Chapter 22, Collaboration. Agility builds collaboration, not competition. Feeds interdependence, not dependence. Empties people's mouths to fill their bellies. Softens their hearts to strengthen their bones. It controls politics by not privileging responsibility. Bureaucracy by not delegating management. Scarcity by not allocating roles. Agility decentralizes ownership and leadership so those who provide them can't exploit them. When no one can take advantage, harmony remains.
And now let's do our exercise that we always do. We have now a leader of a company who heard this and, you know what? Collaboration sounds nice. It has its benefits. Only, how do you start in such a large organization? What do you do? And often the intuitive response is to bring a consultant, to bring some framework, to start a process. And I think this poem has an advice of what can be done internally without any big declarative power changes.
Mm-hmm. Collaboration is about relationship, individuals and interactions. I kind of wish individuals and interactions had mentioned collaboration. It would be nice if it was one of the values in the manifesto. But the leader of an organization, in thinking this way, if they're going to change this, they have to start small. They have to find a way to generate a tiny little ecosystem that works this way. Business, design, delivery, DevOps, all linked together to generate real business throughput that can be measured. Once that's proved, once they know it's working, once they've changed the rules so that they're actually getting the kind of mutual benefit we're talking about here, then they can grow that capability. What they cannot do is push this into an existing team or an existing stream and say, well, now you guys are all going to dance this way instead of the way everybody else is dancing. That doesn't work very well. We have to find the people who want it. And then once they are able to demonstrate they can do it, then we can split their capability down the middle and backfill with people who want to join it. We discover those people usually using an open space, and there's a whole pattern language, a whole toolkit for doing this. Point is, you don't go bottom up, top down, you go inside out. You have to generate that kernel capability and grow it and turn your change participants into change leaders as you go. So it's not about hiring consultants. You might need some to get it started. But it's if you want to really understand what this looks like, how to grow a capability like that, go and watch an old Akira Kurosawa film called The Seven Samurai. And you will learn more about a pull transformation as opposed to a push transformation from that film than anything I can say here.
Okay, so we leave that leader with that answer. Until next time. Before we finish, just as last time, I would propose an exercise to people who would like to meditate a little bit on how they can go in this direction. And what I thought of is this. So perhaps let's take half a minute to think, what conditions do we have that are imposed and block the flow of the team? Team as a unit of collaboration. Team as the people around me who help me achieve something.
Cool.
And the second question that I have is, what can I do to change that?
It's a very empowering question.
So I'll leave you with that question. Thanks a lot. As the music comes in, I'll fare thee well, you and the crickets and the cat. There was a cat as well. And I hope to see you next time.
Take care. See you next time.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.